saying that this fellow persuades men to worship God contrary to the law. So they got Paul and they took him to the Roman proconsul Gallio, and they accused him. Which law are we talking about? Is he talking about Roman law, Corinthian law, Jewish law? Which law are we talking about? Anybody have a idea what law he's talking about there? What's that? Which law is he talking about? Okay. Well, we'll find out here shortly. The context as we go on makes it clear. It says, "And when Paul was about to open his mouth, Gallio said to the Jews, 'If it were a matter of wrongdoing or wicked crimes, O Jews, there would be reason why I should bear with you. But if it is a question of words and names and your own law, look to it yourselves, for I do not want to be a judge of such matters.'" So verses 14 and 15 make it clear what law they were that's being referred to here, and that law is Jewish law. The law was Jewish law. So what's Paul is coming into the city here. He's teaching the truth of the gospel, and that is at variance with the Jewish take on things. And because he's teaching contrary to their beliefs, then they're upset about it. They take it to the Roman proconsul to have him make a decision about it. And Gallio did the only thing that he could do. He had no jurisdiction in this particular matter, because going all the way back to the decrees of Julius Caesar and confirmed by Augustus Caesar, the Jews were a licit religion. Were a licit religion anywhere in the empire. So things had happened when Julius Caesar was in Egypt. And so he was there and he was seeking to prevail, and he wasn't. And he was in fact trapped and didn't have soldiers and things, and the Jews actually intervened to help him with that. And so he looked positively on the Jews as a result of that. And Judaism became a licit religion throughout the Roman Empire. They had the right to establish their places of worship so they could set up synagogues, and they had the right not to have them interfered with and to have their own religious affairs judged according to their own religious law without interference from religious Roman officials. So he had no right to interfere here, and so he made the right judgment. He said, You guys decide this yourselves. So he's telling them, this is a matter of your own religious laws, and I'm not going to get involved. So the Jews were seeking to shut down Paul's preaching and persecuting Paul and the Christians because of their beliefs and the preaching that was going on. Now let's go to Acts chapter 17. Acts chapter 17. And look at verse 1. So we're going to mostly be in the book of Acts. We'll bounce around in the book of Acts, but we'll be in the book of Acts because that lays the groundwork for the questions that were asked. Acts chapter 17, verse 1. "Now when they had passed through Amphipolis and Apollonia, they came to Thessalonica, where there was a synagogue of the Jews. Then Paul, as his custom was, sent to them, and went into them and for three Sabbaths reasoned with them from the Scriptures, explaining and demonstrating that Christ had to suffer and rise again from the dead, and saying, 'This Jesus, whom I preach to you, is the Christ.' And some of them were persuaded, and a great multitude of devout Greeks and not a few of the leading women joined Paul and Silas." And then we come to verse 5. It says, "But the Jews who were not persuaded, Becoming envious, took some of the evil men from the marketplace, and gathering a mob, set all the city in an uproar, and attacked the house of Jason, and sought to bring them out to the people." The question that we asked there was, why were the Jews envious? Why were the Jews envious? Anybody have any input on that? Why were the Jews envious? Mr. Sappington?
Well, Paul and Silas were they were being very successful, and there were multitudes that were turning to them and not to the Jewish leadership. And so they were losing followers, and they wanted to have that stopped. They were envious of what the reception that they were getting from the multitude.
Okay. That seems to be as you look at it, that might be the conclusion, but it's actually something else. So that probably bothered them, but that wasn't the big issue with them, as we'll see. As you look here, it says that they gathered a mob, set all the city in an uproar, and attacked the house of Jason. And what you have to realize, in Greek cities, this wasn't unusual. There was always there were always guys hanging out that were looking for some stir, and it was easy to stir them up. This was just commonplace in Greek cities of the time. We can, as you look through secular sources, there were these people that were ready, oh, let's riot and do whatever, and they were more than happy to go along with that. And to me, it was always interesting as I studied the Apostle Paul that wherever the Apostle Paul went and preached, almost always there's some upheaval or riot, almost in every case. So I thought, man, what a troublemaker that Paul was. But anyway, he would preach and other people would get stirred up and raise a riot in the city. And they were moved to envy, and as Mr. Sappington pointed out, that there was a positive response and a lot of people were responding. And you might think, shouldn't they have glorified God that the Gentiles were beginning to acknowledge the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob? Even though it was in a different way than the Jews normally honored God, at least they were beginning to acknowledge that deity. Why were they envious? Because we still haven't gotten to the answer yet. So we go back to an earlier chapter in Acts 13. And let's look at verses 42 through 45. Acts chapter 13, verses 42 through 45. We'll begin in verse 32. It says, "So when the Jews went out of the synagogue, the Gentiles begged that these words might be preached to them the next Sabbath. Now, when the congregation had broken up, many of the Jews and devout proselytes followed Paul and Barnabas, who, speaking to them, persuaded them to continue in the grace of God." Verse 44, "On the next Sabbath, almost the whole city came together to hear the word of God." So this would, if you're looking at this, it would tend to support Mr. Sappington's point. "The news of the preaching of Paul and Barnabas spread like wildfire." So you had all of these people coming out and responding to the preaching of Paul and Barnabas. Verse 45, "But when the Jews saw the multitudes, they were filled with envy. And contradicting and blaspheme, they oppose the things spoken by Paul." So they're opposing the things spoken by Paul. So what was Paul saying that they found they had envy of? Why is envy spoken of these two times as being the motivating force for the antagonism that the Jews that did not believe felt toward Paul? And why did they begin to stir up the population against them? In the case of Iconium, after having spoken in the synagogue in chapter 14 of Acts, we read in chapter 14, verse 1, "Now it happened in Iconium that they went together to the synagogue of the Jews and so spoke that a great multitude both of Jews and of the Greeks believed. But the unbelieving Jews stirred up the Gentiles and poisoned their minds against the brethren." So Paul is receiving a lot of opposition. Let's go down. Let's go to Acts chapter 14 and look at verse 19. Acts chapter 14 and look at 19. Acts chapter 14, verse 19, it says, "Then the Jews from Antioch and Iconium came there, and having persuaded the multitudes, they stoned Paul and dragged him out of the city, supposing him to be dead." Well, Paul rose up from the stoning and went right back into the city, which is quite the gutsy move. And so why were the Jews so envious, that they would take such drastic measures? Is this simply a matter of Paul attracting more preaching and teaching than the Jews? They looked at this and they had a Jewish missionary work and it had not been as successful. The source of envy is involved, but it goes much deeper than just success in gaining adherence to follow their particular way. The next question we come to points us in the direction we want to go to try to answer this. Were the envious Jews against Gentiles turning to God? What did they expect of the Gentile converts? Now, this really gets to the heart of the matter. Why were they envious? Were the envious Jews against Gentiles turning to God? What did they expect of the Gentile converts? Anybody have an idea? Mr. Corley.
I would presume they expected circumcision from them.
That's correct. They were envious because what Paul is offering these individuals that are responding, he's saying that they don't need to go through circumcision and all the law of Moses from their particular perspective. They don't have to do that. They're just upset by that we've had to do all this and they don't have to. What was the thing they were trying to stress to the Gentiles? They were basically saying, sure, you can come to Christ, but you have to come to him by becoming a Jew first. You have to become a Jew first. Because this message of salvation is for Israelites only. And unless you become an Israelite by circumcision and practicing the whole law, you cannot be an Israelite and you cannot receive salvation. So if you first become an Israelite, then you can receive the message of salvation. And that's why they tended to push the issue of circumcision. And there's nothing wrong with being circumcised, but the point is they were requiring circumcision. You know, you can be circumcised, but it has nothing to do with salvation. And it may mean that you're a part of the community of Israel even, you know, as far as a physical nation. But as far as the spiritual things in salvation, it's not necessary. I was speaking with a minister here recently, and he was talking about speaking to someone that believes circumcision is still necessary. And this is in 21st century America that they believe circumcision is still necessary, which I thought, really? But that's the world we live in, that people have such opinions. So they said you've got to become circumcised. And they were saying you cannot be a Christian unless you're circumcised first. You cannot come to Christ unless you become a Jew first. You have to enter into the covenant of Abraham before you can be accepted and have the blood of Jesus applied to pay the penalty of your sins. So is that true? Is that true? So if somebody brought that up, how would you refute that? What would you say? Where would you turn? Where would you turn in order to refute that particular idea? Mr. Henniger?
I believe it's the circumcision of the heart is what we're looking at now in the New Testament times.
It is circumcision of the heart. And, yes, Mr. Sappington?
Galatians 3, 28 and 29.
And that says?
There is neither Jew nor Greek. There is neither bond nor free.
That's true. And male or female.
And if you be in Christ, you're Abraham's seed. So.
Right. Right. It's circumcision isn't the issue any longer. But for these people with their background, it was still the issue. And for people to come to Christ, to become Christians, they needed to go through this. This is why Paul had to address this issue in different places and in different ways. For instance, he says in Romans chapter 5, verse 6, there he says, for when we were still without strength in due time, Christ died for the ungodly. He didn't die for the circumcised, he died for the ungodly. So circumcision wasn't the issue. And for scarcely for a righteous man will one die, yet perhaps for a good man someone will even dare to die. But God demonstrates his love toward us, he says in verse 8, in that while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. So he emphasized that Christ died for us, and he stressed the fact that Abraham received favor from God after he was circumcised or before he was circumcised. Before. He received God's favor even before the covenant of circumcision was introduced. And he's trying to separate the two and trying to make it clear that it is not necessary for Gentiles to approach Christ through membership in the Jewish community. You don't have to be Jewish or be a part of that community to come to Christ. We have to understand that the Jews who lived in the Greek world lived at best as a tolerated minority and frequently as a despised minority in the Greek cities. And they were spread throughout the Greek-speaking world. And they were spread out, and that being spread out was called, we would say, the dispersion. And they were, it's called in Greek, the dispersion means the same thing. They were spread out throughout the Greek-speaking world. There was probably only one major Greek city where they were not in this condition of just basically being tolerated. In Sardis, they were actually well regarded. How do we know that? How do we know that? And the reason is because of the very important role they played in the business affairs of the city. As you looked at the Roman world, you know, today, where is a lot of business transacted? In what recreational setting is a lot of business transacted? Anybody? Golf. They play golf. And they talk business. They hit those little white balls and they make deals. Is that right? All right. They do. I know. But we're not making any deals either for most of us. But anyway, they make deals on the golf course. And in the Roman world, where did they go to make deals? Does anybody have an idea where they went to make deals in the Roman world? It was in the bathhouse. So they had the bathhouses and they would make, and there was no negative connotation to the bathhouse in their time. That's where they would transact business. And if you were in the Greek world, where did you go? There was a particular place you went. They had the gymnasium. So for the Greeks, they transacted business at the gymnasium. Now, in Sardis, you had a synagogue there, and part of the synagogue was used for prayers and for worship, for their services. But there was another portion of the synagogue that there was a meeting hall that wasn't a religious meeting hall. And they would go to this meeting hall in the city of Sardis in order to transact business. So the Jews in that particular place were well regarded, and they would work out deals there. As I said, if you went to the synagogue in Capernaum, you had a room, and you can go to that synagogue today. You find a room for prayers, and you also find a meeting room. And outside of Sardis, the Jews were at best a tolerated minority, and more often a despised one. And as the Jews experienced this reception where they lived, then for their own self-protection and their own sense of self-worth, they had this feeling that, hey, listen, you guys may despise us now, but we know that we've been promised a Messiah. And when he comes, it's going to be different. It's going to be different. And then we will be top dog here, and you may be laughing at us now, but when we're the top dog, we'll get the last laugh. And what's happening is Paul's coming along, and these Jews have this perspective. He comes along, and he's telling everybody that the same promise, the promise of the Messiah, and their being exalted, is available to them. They've not had to be circumcised. They've not been a despised minority. They've not had to go through all of the washings and all of the ablutions and things that they've practiced. They haven't had to go through any of that. They've not had to bear up all of the insults and things they've had to go through. They didn't like going through all that. And here's Paul coming along saying, you don't have to do any of that. And so they were envious of the Gentiles for that very reason. And the idea that ran through their minds was this: why have I gone through all this extra special attempt to do special things if it doesn't obtain me any special treatment? You know, you might go back and think about what Christ said. He promised everybody, if you work in the field, at the end of the day, you'll get one penny. Isn't that what he said? So you had certain people that were in there out there working for a long time, and you had these people that were added at the end, and they didn't work as long, and they're all going to get a penny. So the people that were in there working longer said, this is not fair. And Christ said, what is it to you if I work it out this way? It's not fair from your perspective, but you agreed to work for a penny, didn't you? Well, yeah, we did. Well, that's the deal we made. That's the contract we entered into. And they entered into the same contract. And so they were resentful of this. They were envious. And they're basically saying, I'm on the same level as the Gentiles who never kept the ritual law. And this made them envious. It greatly bothered them. And obviously, as you think about what approach they had, it's a carnal approach. It's not a humble, submissive approach. It's a carnal approach. That this is unfair. And so they were upset by the Gentiles not having to keep all of the ritual laws. And you can see that conflict playing out in Acts chapter 15. We're not going to talk about that in detail today, but we will eventually, as we talk about the subject of the law, we will cover that in detail because it's good to understand exactly what's going on there and what's being said. So that takes us up to question number 17. Question number 17, which says, what was the tension that was found in the Church of God after the day of Pentecost, 31 A.D.? And how was it manifested? What was the tension that you found in the church after the church was founded in 31 A.D.? Was there a tension? And if so, what was the tension? What was the tension? In one sense, we could say it was growing pains. A tension that existed as as the church expanded beyond its Jewish or even Samaritan roots to include Gentiles from the Greek-speaking world. So this was something big. This was something big that the church had to adjust to, and it took them a while to do so. And it was something for the young church that had to deal with, and there was a great deal of uncertainty about it. So we know about the conflict in Acts chapter 15, as we've said. We're not going to talk about that in detail today. So if, as you think about this question, what was about the tension, what was the norm between Jew and Gentile in the time of Jesus Christ and beyond? How did Jews and Gentiles in the time of Jesus Christ, and as the church was founded, what was the normal interaction between the two groups? What was the norm between Jew and Gentile in the time of Jesus Christ and beyond? They got along perfectly and there were no questions. Yes, sir. Fred?
Basically, enmity between the two, that they should not, or the Jews should not intermingle with the Gentiles, pretty much as the, carry over from the Old Testament times.
Okay.
Up to that time.
So there was tension when they interacted, Jews and Gentiles coming together. And, many of the Jews had hang-ups about eating freely and visiting freely with Christians who had come from a Gentile background because of their upbringing. So as they didn't just come right together and get along with no questions. They had their challenges to work out. What had been the norm in Palestine is that they did not enter into a home of a Gentile, because if you did, what happened? What happened to you? Do you remember we talked about the centurion in Capernaum who asked Christ to heal his servant? And he said, you don't have to come to my house to heal him. You can command. You have the power to command that he would be healed, and he will be healed. Why didn't he want Christ to... Why did he say, you don't have to come into my house? James?
Because then he would be unclean, and he'd have to go through some rituals before he would be deemed clean again.
Correct. So if Christ came into the centurion's house, he would be considered unclean, and he would have to go through certain ritual purification in order to be made clean. And he'd have to go through certain ceremonies for a period of time prior to being able to participate again in the rituals and ceremonies of the Jews. So this was just the way it was in the time of Jesus Christ. Now, this question is interesting in question number 19. Where in God's laws, statutes, and judgments does God tell his people to be totally separate from Gentiles? Where in God's laws, statutes, and judgments does God tell his people to be totally separate from Gentiles? Anybody have an idea? Yes, Sherry? Hold on a second.
I'm not certain, but I don't think that he tells them to be 100% separate from the Gentiles.
You're right. You're right. He doesn't. It's not in the God's laws. If you go through the Bible, that's not in there. So where did that come? It's not in God's law, but it's in the oral law as expounded by the Pharisees as a way to build a fence around the Torah. So the Jews had suffered being taken into captivity because they broke God's law. One of the problems they have was intermarrying with the native people and adopting the false religions of the surrounding peoples. So they said, you know what, we're going to prevent this by putting a hedge around the law so you can't interact with them. And therefore, we're not going to have this problem in the future. And if you build a fence around this, then it's going to keep you from intermarrying with the Gentiles. You can't intermarry with people that you don't socialize with. And one of the major ways that we socialize is eating together. So if you don't eat together with the Gentiles, you don't socialize with them, you're probably not going to marry them. And if you never eat with them in their homes and you do not invite them into your home, you can't get to know them to run the risk of intermarrying. So the Jews who practiced this put a distance between themselves and the Gentiles. And later on, of course, because they had backed off that far, other attitudes began to creep in. Other attitudes toward the Gentiles, such as a very strong negative feeling toward them as being inferior. The Gentiles were seen by the people that were zealous for God as inferior. And this was something that was not intended by the Pharisaic leaders, but it was seems to be a natural outcome of not interacting with these people. You begin to look down on them, and eventually you don't want anything to do with them. And you probably all remember in elementary school when you were running around and you had somebody touched you, you got cooties from them, and you'd brush them off and all of that. It's a childhood thing that some of us experienced when we were kids on the playground. And it was kind of the same thing. When you do that, people are offended when you do that. You know, who? Don't touch me. You're dirty or whatever. And that was kind of the approach that they have. So the question number 20, did the apostles of Christ grow up in this environment, and did it impact them? How do we know that they were impacted by this particular mindset? What can we see in the scriptures that tell us that they were impacted? So first of all, did they grow up in this environment? Okay, some are shaking their head, yes, okay. And then how do we know that they were impacted by this environment? What happened? Anybody cite anything that would tell you that they were impacted by this environment? Sherry?
After God made it known to Peter that they were supposed to accept the Gentiles and not keep them separate because God is working with them as well, and there was a time after that where Peter was supposed to be dining with them and set himself apart because he didn't want to be set apart by the other apostles or other people of the Jewish descent because he thought that they would frown upon him, and then he was reprimanded for doing that. So that's the only account that I can recall.
Right. I mean, if you look at Peter originally when he went to speak to, you know, he was led by the Spirit to go to the house of Cornelius. When he went into that house, preached to them, people were outraged by that. And so they were upset by what he did. The only reason they backed off is because the Spirit of God was poured out on the house of Cornelius. How can you refute that? So Peter was off the hook then. But you had these people that still believed that for you to be a Christian and reap salvation, come to Christ, you had to become a Jew. And so they were very strong in this. So when they came up to where Paul and Peter were, Peter and Barnabas had been eating with the Gentiles. Now when these individuals come up from Jerusalem and put the pressure on them and call into question they're eating with the Gentiles, well, what do Peter and Barnabas do? They quit eating with the Gentiles. And Paul said, that's not going to fly. We can't let this go. And he confronted Peter because he saw that if we continue this, you're going to have two groups. We can't have two groups. We are one church, Jew, Gentile, all bound together through the Spirit. Christ dying for Jew and Gentile. We are one body. And even though the apostles had grown up in this environment, they had to get past it. They had to get past it. For instance, the Apostle James, Christ's brother, was the head of the Jerusalem church after the other apostles had left on their various missionary journeys. And James was always held in high regard by the Jewish community. And although they were not pleased with the Nazarenes, as they called Christians, they tended to regard James highly. In fact, the Jews called him James the Just. Because although it was not required that he keep the ritual items of the law, he voluntarily did so. And if you remember, when Paul was arrested for the final time and ultimately taken to Rome, James asked him to pay the vows of individuals who had taken a vow and were going to finish it up in the temple, and he would pay their vows. He would take care of that for them, and he would finish up things with them. And so Paul's in the temple finishing this up. Let's not offend the Jews. Let's try to maintain a good relationship with them. Well, some of the Jews that were from Asia Minor were in Jerusalem, and they saw Paul in there. They knew Paul's interaction with the Gentiles, and they raised a big ruckus and say, well, he's brought a Gentile into the temple area, which wasn't true. Because they had seen him with a man called Trophimus. And he hadn't brought him in there at all. So there's this big riot, and they're grabbing onto him. I think it would be amazing to be back in that time, all the riots and seeing them pulling on Paul and one group pulling him. You know, you have the Sadducees and Pharisees pulling on him at a later situation when he's being tried. But it is interesting what the world was like there at that particular time. You know, you could do this. You could make these offerings and things, but it was not necessary. It was something that they did in order to keep peace. And they did it up until the time when the temple fell. When the temple fell, it's over. There is no more temple. And they had to come to that realization. Even some of the religious leaders among the Jews were very upset when James was killed. They thought it was a grave injustice, and they felt that their community was going to suffer the consequences for killing this just man. So as you look at this particular issue, this is very much in spirit of what Paul himself wrote about all things are lawful to me, meaning that they're within the bounds of God's law, but not all are expedient, meaning it's something better not to use one's liberty and emblazon it like a red flag in front of a bull. So just because you do not have to go through all of the rituals and ablutions and washings like the Jews do, you don't have to do that. But why just rub it in their face? Why not try to get along with them? Which is, it's not sin to do it. It's just not necessary. So Paul was able to see that, hey, look, I don't have to be offensive. But Paul also called a spade a spade, and sometimes when you call a spade, it's, you know, the other party's offended, even though what you're saying is the truth. So it's better not to use everything you're allowed to do just because, you know, you see the bigger picture and it will serve the work better. So that doesn't mean, you know, that you compromise with God's law. That's never on the table. But it means where you can find a way to get along with other people, you get along with them. So you don't try to deliberately be offensive, hurtful. And that's how Paul approached his ministry, because he dealt with Jews, he dealt with Gentiles. And sometimes, and we'll see an example here where he had to adjust how he preached the gospel to a degree. Question number 21, why was Paul such a unique tool in God's hands? Why was Paul such a unique tool in God's hands? Mr. Henniger?
Because of his past education in the Jewish religion, and he knew Greek philosophy, he knew lots of stuff. And so he was able to preach in their direction.
Correct. Anybody else have any input? What made Paul unique? Why was he a unique tool? Mr. Henniger was correct. And as you look at Paul was a very unique individual, and he said that he was a very zealous Pharisee, and he was very knowledgeable of all of the rules that were involved in Phariseeism. And he's not lying or being vain when he says that he's an Israelite of the Israelites or a Pharisee of the Pharisees. Like Ezra, who was a ready scribe of the law of Moses. He knew his law backward and forward. Although he was given a Jewish religious upbringing, since his father was a Roman citizen and a businessman, he had contacts with the Gentiles as a result. So he lived in the Jewish world and in the Gentile world. He had exposure to both. And it's quite evident from certain comments that work their way into his letters or into the book of Acts that he has a knowledge of Greek literature and philosophy and is able to use those in order to make a point that his audience would understand. So he's quite familiar with those things. You know, it's like if you go back to Ambassador College, that's what we were seeking to do, was take the best of, to give people a liberal arts education, to give them the best of education from a worldly perspective, the best of that education, music and science and art and all of that, those things that are uplifting and positive and noble, which there are some, and also to give them a full education in God's truth. That way you would be well-rounded individuals, hopefully, who can function in the world. not to just look at the Bible only, but to be well-rounded so you can function on all levels in the world in which we live. So Paul was well-educated in a liberal arts sense, as well as being educated in Judaism. And this fitted him to do the job of an apostle of Jesus Christ. He was well-suited for it, and he could function in any situation. So what I want to concentrate on in the rest of the study are the unique features of a number of churches that Paul dealt with and how that played a role in his ability to spread the gospel. So let's go back to Acts chapter 13. Acts chapter 13 and look at verse 1. Acts chapter 13, verse 1. Now in the church that was at Antioch, there were certain prophets and teachers, Barnabas, Simeon, who was called Niger, Lucius of Cyrene, Manaen, who had been brought up with Herod the Tetrarch, and Saul, later to become Paul. As they ministered to the Lord and fasted, the Holy Spirit said, "Now separate to me Barnabas and Saul for the work to which I have called them." So Paul and Barnabas were separated. God somehow made it clear that he wanted them separated to go forward and preach the gospel in other areas. And the first real place where Paul spoke to a large body of individuals was in Antioch of Pisidia. And we see that in Acts chapter 13, verse 14. Acts chapter 13, verse 14. It says, "But when they departed from Perga," which is in Asia Minor, further south of Antioch, which is kind of in the middle of the country, "they came to Antioch in Pisidia, and they went into the synagogue on the Sabbath day and sat down." So they come into the synagogue, and they sat down. And interestingly, just a little point that you can amaze and wow your friends with, it shouldn't be Antioch in Pisidia, because Antioch isn't in the area of Pisidia. Antioch is by Pisidia. So technically speaking, it should be Antioch by Pisidia. So there's been the question, is that salvational? That isn't. That's just something interesting. So, anyway, you go to verse 15, Acts chapter 13, verse 15. And there it says, "And after reading of the law and the prophets, the rulers of the synagogue sent to them, saying, 'Men and brethren, if you have any word of exhortation for the people, say on.'" So the question here that comes up as a result of chapter 13, verse 15 is that speaks of reading the law and the prophets. So what's being described, and when did this practice start? So this is a question about how services went in the synagogue. So, anybody have any? Yes, Mr. Corley.
Thank you. The original start of the reading of the law, the commandment for the reading of the law, was in Deuteronomy 31. I presume, which was referred to the law to be read every 7 years at the Feast of Tabernacles. And then, as synagogues were established after the Babylonian exile, they started reading portions of it each Sabbath in the synagogue.
Okay. All right. There's truth there. Anything else? So does anybody know when they began to read the law in the synagogue? So it was after the captivity, and the Jews have been dispersed throughout first of all, the Persian Empire, and later on the Greek Empire. So when did they start reading the law in the synagogues? Anybody have an idea when that took place? Well, actually, it took place in the time of Ezra. Ezra set in motion the cyclical reading of portions of the law so people would be constantly reminded of it. So they started out reading the law. When did they add the prophets? When did they start reading not only the law, but the prophets? Anybody remember that? When did they begin reading the prophets? Well, that traces back to the time of Antiochus Epiphanes. And Antiochus Epiphanes outlawed the reading of the law in the synagogue. So they said, well, we still want to focus on God's truths, so we'll find a workaround. So what they did is they searched out, so you had to read a certain passage of the law at a certain time in the year. So when that time of the year came about, then they found portions of the prophets that they could read that had similar points that were made. So they established the reading of the prophets in Antiochus Epiphanes' time so that they can continue to read. So once Antiochus Epiphanes, he was defeated and no longer was a problem, they said, well, we're not going to give up the reading of the prophets and the law. So they went back to reading the law, but they continued to read the prophets as well. So we come down to the time of the Apostle Paul, and they're still reading the law and the prophets on a regular basis, and they still do that to this day. They still do that to this day. They read first from the law, the assigned section, and then they read the assigned section from the prophets. And usually the incident in the prophets has its central core, the same teaching as is found in the law. This was the normal service. So as what's being described here in verse 15, the normal part of the service was over. Doesn't mean the entire service was over, but the main part was over, and the rulers of the synagogue said, "Men and brethren, if you have any words of exhortation for the people, say on." So if there were visitors in the community, they would allow them to kind of give an update on other Jewish communities. And if they were qualified to speak and they had been trained in that, then they were allowed to give a more scriptural talk, which Paul, having been trained, takes advantage of the opportunity. It would be like a visiting minister giving a sermon. So Paul begins to speak to these people. And that brings us to the next question. Paul says, "Men and brethren, men of Israel, and you who fear God, listen." That's what he says in verse 16. So he says, "Men of Israel, and you who fear God, listen." So is he being redundant when he says, "Men of Israel, and you who fear God, listen"? Aren't the men of Israel also men who fear God? So isn't he talking to the same group? Mr. Corley.
Wasn't God, the term God-fearers, used as a term for Gentiles who had partially converted to Judaism, but who might not yet be circumcised?
Well, if the men of Israel, they're Jews. And as you said, who are the people who fear God? Well, as you said, they're Gentiles. And they're not Gentile proselytes, because a Gentile proselyte would be one of the men of Israel. You've been circumcised, so you're part of Israel. Okay, you're part of that community. But these people were God-fearers. They had not gone through the ceremony of circumcision. They were God-fearers. They were also called proselytes at the gate. In other words, they became committed to God's laws all the way to the point of circumcision. And at that particular time, circumcision, you had to really think that through. Do I want to go through this? Because of infections and different issues that could come up. And so they chose not to. But in every other way, they were part of the religious community. But they were not circumcised. And it wasn't, as I said, it wasn't pleasant, nor was it safe. So rather than go through circumcision, they said, "We'll observe all of the points of the law that God commands, but we're not going to do this." So apparently, that's the sense in which Cornelius is referred to as a God-fearer. He had embraced everything of God's religion except circumcision. Okay? So that's who Paul is addressing here, the men of Israel and those who fear God. And you see that he's speaking of two separate groups. The next question is number 24. And it says, Paul's sermon in Antioch in Pisidia, or by Pisidia, was laced with scriptures. How was it that the Gentiles in attendance could understand his sermon? I mean, didn't they speak it? Wasn't it all in Hebrew? Didn't they read from the Hebrew scriptures? It was all in Hebrew. So how are these Gentiles, Greek speakers, going to understand anything? For instance, if you go to the synagogue today, it's in Hebrew. Now, you have a Bible you can follow along in, but it's going to be in Hebrew. Mr. Corley, you had an answer?
Could he have preached from the Septuagint?
They preached from the Septuagint.
Which they did have.
They preached from the Septuagint. And you know, Paul's, if you look at what Paul says, his sermon is very much laced with a lot of biblical things. You know, it's a very biblically based sermon that he gives to them. He says in verse 17, he said, "The God of this people Israel, chose our fathers and exalted the people when they dwelt as strangers in the land of Egypt, and with an uplifted arm he brought them out of it. Now for a time of about 40 years." So he goes through this whole sermon and explains all of these things to them, it's very biblically based. And the Gentiles were able to keep up with all of this. They were able to keep up with all of it. They're not ignorant of the scriptures. And as was said, the sermon was given in Greek. The sermon was given in Greek. And Paul's able to give a scripturally oriented sermon for that very reason. He knows that not just the Jews, but also the God-fearers can understand the content of the message. And today, as I said, if you go to a synagogue, they're going to preach in Hebrew. Now, in Paul's day, it's interesting, it was a unique time. In Paul's day, and going all the way back to about the middle of the, into the second century, they had begun to use Greek. They translated the Hebrew scriptures into Greek, what we know as the Septuagint version of the Bible, and all the way down to Paul's time, they continued to speak in Greek and to allow that communication to take place so that everybody could understand. There came a point in the Jewish community where they said, you know, for us to hold it together as a community, we're going to have to hold on to the Hebrew roots. And that's when they went back to the Hebrew as opposed to Greek and the Septuagint. So the God-fearers had been there. They were familiar with the scriptures. So they heard the truth preached. Let's go to Acts chapter 13, verse 42. Acts chapter 13, verse 42. It says, so he's given this sermon. And in verse 42 it says, "So when the Jews went out of the synagogue, the Gentiles begged that these words might be preached to them the next Sabbath." So this is an interesting point. If you look at the Greek of Acts 13, verse 32, there is a translation of I saw Sabbath, and I also saw a reading that says the next day of the reading of the Torah, the next day when the Torah would be read. Because if you went to one of these Greek cities, in the synagogue, they would read the Torah on the Sabbath, and they would also read the Torah on Monday, and they would also read it on Thursday. So they're saying, can you read this? Can you share these truths with us the next time the Torah is read, which would have been Monday? Regardless of whether it was Monday or Sabbath, they still preached the truth to them. They still preached the truth to them. And when the congregation had broken up, many of the Jews and devout proselytes followed Paul and Barnabas, who, speaking to them, persuaded them to continue in the grace of God. Talks about devout proselytes. Those are people who, full proselyte, not God-fearers, they had gone through the process of circumcision. So those individuals were part of the congregation as well. In Acts 13, verse 44, it says, "On the next Sabbath, almost the whole city came together to hear the word of God. And so all of these people came out to hear the word of God expounded. And this points out that you had the Jews heard the message, but you also have the God-fearers, who are Greeks, hearing the message, and you also have the proselytes. So you're reaching the entire community, Jews and Gentiles, some of who are part of Israel and who are not. And they're businessmen, they're people from the whole community, and they were all relating what they heard. They were all relating that. And so as a result of that, they everybody was able to hear the gospel. And so we can see here that they were able to hear the gospel preached, and this was how Paul would enter a city and go to the synagogue and speak to them, and then he would go on to the next group. So we're going to leave it there today, and we'll come back and finish this up in July. And we've got a few more points to make, and we'll also begin looking at something else that we can learn about God's Word. So hopefully you found it profitable. I appreciate you staying and your participation. For those of you who answered questions, and for all of you who listened, appreciate that as well. So please be careful as you go home, and hopefully we'll have a drier week ahead. So have a good remainder of the Sabbath.